I spent two of the most valuable years of my student life in a small monastic kind of seminary in Tennessee, where the doors were locked at 7 o'clock each weekday evening to encourage homework, and where social life was limited to Sunday evening visits in the parlor of the girls' dormitory under the watchful eyes of their wise and matronly Miss Wilson. As you might guess, we used to have some vigorous faculty-student debates about the tyranny of that place, including how we were expected to dress for class. Professor L.L. Briggins and Professor Witty Claude Hall, may they rest in peace, they were wonderful men, both felt that there was a relationship between how people dress and how they behave, and that if we got too sloppy in our clothes, it would be reflected in our mental and physical conduct. We respectfully argued back that the more comfortable we were, the harder we could work without fatigue. The faculty would then read a passage in chapel from Isaiah, "Awake, awake, put on your beautiful garments, O Jerusalem," which was stretching logic pretty far, of course. So we would post a rebuttal sign on the official campus bulletin from Matthew's gospel. "Therefore, I tell you, do not be anxious about your body, what you shall put on." And so the mock serious battle went back and forth. We had more fun, but the faculty had more power. So the faculty won, and we dressed neatly. Years later, I was on the other side of that debate, particularly in the 60s, arguing as a faculty member that some discipline in dress gets transferred to mental attitudes, while the students seem to feel that the more rumpled and ragged the dress, the easier it was for the mind to think great thoughts. Same old arguments. 25 years later, the only difference being that this time it was the students who won the contest. All of which I mention only as a way of talking about a man in one of the parables who went to the right party but wore the wrong dress. The parable describes a wedding feast, which is no great surprise. A remarkable number of the short stories told by Jesus to light up the kingdom are built around the events of a wedding. If you were here last week, you may remember that we talked about a brief parable in which Jesus described a man who came to a wedding reception, took the best seat he could find, and then was embarrassed by having to move out of it for a guest of higher standing who arrived late. I suppose Jesus liked to use parables about weddings and the parties that sometimes lasted for several days because they were among the chief social events of his village life. His mother would have told him about things that happened at her wedding. His sisters, at least two of them, and perhaps more, would all likely have had their own weddings before he ever began to teach in public. So if he decided to illustrate some idea by analogy with a wedding, he could count on the country people to understand. I do think it's instructive that he chose weddings instead of something else. There were, after all, courts of law. He might have stressed the rules of kingdom life. There were schools. He might have said, if you study long enough and hard enough, you will graduate by and by into the kingdom of right relationships. There was an army visible every day. He might have said, discipline. That's what it takes to please God. Coming into the kingdom is like the structured life of the barracks. Exercise drills, meals only at specified times, bed checks, early morning reveille. But he chose none of those things. He chose weddings, probably the happiest events he could remember from his childhood. All that food and drink, dancing and music, party dresses and laughter. So much laughter, in fact, that sometimes one had trouble hearing much else. It's a great pity, I think, that so many people who profess the Christian faith seem not to have caught on to what all this wedding business means. They are sober and serious folk. Their faces are stern, sometimes even noble, but they don't seem to have much fun. Somebody said once that we ask God to forgive us for evil thoughts and bad temper, but rarely, if ever, ask Him to forgive us for being gloomy. Some of us are the children of the scribes and the Pharisees who did a lot of fasting and a great deal of very public praying and spoke of religion primarily as a burden. They simply could not comprehend the young rabbi from Nazareth who came along and said, "Lighten up, gentlemen," or in the more formal translations we use, "These things I have spoken to you that my joy may remain in you and that your joy may be full." His joy, it seems to have been remarkable. No wonder he liked to talk about weddings. In John's gospel, in fact, one of the very first stories told about Jesus has him present at a wedding where the festivities went on so long and so happily that the poor host ran out of wine and got help from Jesus in providing some more. I'm not sure we represent this man very well. And in parenthesis, I say we only to be polite. You are the happiest people I've ever been around. So happy, in fact, that I have to plead with you about once a month to pause in your happiness at being together and seek out a visitor with whom to share it. But I have been around people not quite so happy. The kind of people, I suppose, that Nietzsche had in mind when he told some Christians who wanted to convert him, "You will have to look more redeemed if I am to believe in your Redeemer." How does one look who looks redeemed? I would assume, since to be redeemed is to be brought back from slavery, to be returned to life and freedom after death and darkness, that the faces of the redeemed would be alive with excitement. You don't always see that in church. full of curiosity, quick to smile, touched with an increasingly beautiful sensitivity to all the light and shadow of their new gift of days. In other words, exactly the way we would look if life in the kingdom really were for us like one of those delightful weddings that Jesus kept turning into parables, one of which I am finally ready now to describe. It was not the usual village celebration, but something more exciting yet, the wedding of a king's son or daughter, so lavish in planning and production that people talked of little else for weeks before and weeks after. Just to get an invitation would mark you as one of the luckiest in town. So on the big day, the guests put together the best outfit they can buy or borrow and set out for the party by a route that will take them past the houses of as many envious neighbors as possible. Kings like to make a late entrance, so once at the party, the guests dance and talk and drink wine for a while, filled with suspense about when the wedding party will enter and how they will look. Like people everywhere, they check to see who's there and who isn't, who has on the most interesting clothes, and perhaps, at least at this particular wedding, some of them may have whispered about one costume that seemed out of place, although no one had the temerity to say so to the person wearing it. And then suddenly, down at one end of the hall, there is a fanfare of trumpets. The talk and laughter stop, and the king comes in with his handsomely dressed retinue trailing along behind him. He nods to someone here and makes that person's day, smiles to a woman there and creates envy in a dozen other hearts, and then abruptly his face darkens and those who are close see that his eye has fallen on a man dressed as if he had worked late on the farm and had had no time to change, or had kept the store open late and come in his clerk's rumpled apron. If the other guests have been polite enough not to confront that man, not so the king. How did you happen to come here, not having on a wedding garment? The question gives the man a moment to explain, but the parable says he is speechless. For whatever reason, he has taken the event too lightly. The king says, "Show this man the door." It leaves a few real-life questions unanswered, but it is, after all, a story, contrived to make a point, and the point is not very difficult. The parable says in a fairly straightforward way that life in the kingdom, life in the church, is meant to be as full of delight as a village wedding. But that once we accept the invitation, we are expected to wear the right dress. Not the kind you can see readily, as in the parable itself, but a kind of interior dress, which you infer from what people say and do. The best commentary on the parable is from another word spoken by Christ. Except you change and become like little children, you cannot enter the kingdom of God. In other words, we can't be blasé, condescending, detached, aloof. Those are not the appropriate garments. Arbitrary and accidental differences in education, wealth, fame, or lack of it, we hang those on the coat rack in the foyer and forget them when we enter this room. It's possible, among other mistakes in dress, to be too casual. The appropriate dress for worship is a genuine sense of reverence. We don't have to be stiff. We can be warm and friendly, deeply happy, but the parable says we should also never forget where we are. I once had a man light a cigarette from the communion table candle, having forgotten, I suppose, that he was not in a nightclub. It hardly seemed the right dress. This is also one place in life where we are under a mandate to be honest, to come in each week still wearing the tattered robes of pretense is to risk hearing, if we have ears to hear, the King tell us firmly to go home and change. Honesty was once the norm. It seems almost now to be the exception, so that we are surprised and delighted by it. I just read of how a young minister came one time to talk with Bishop Gerald Kennedy of the Methodist Church. Kennedy thought he knew exactly what the young man wanted. He said there had been trouble in his church, and I expected he wanted to tell me that it was not his fault and that he ought not to be moved. He sat down and said, "Bishop, you may have heard that some of the lay people in my church are unhappy." I admitted I had heard that. "Well," he went on, "I don't blame them. They have been patient with me for 6 years, and they ought to have a chance for something better. I do not have all the gifts a man needs for this job. They have been kinder to me than I deserved." I don't know whether that young man went on in the ministry or ever got very good at it, but he was dressed in the right clothes. And the bishop says, "I was prejudiced in that young man's favor for the rest of my days." It doesn't hurt us to be reminded of humility and reverence and honesty, but they are not really why I chose this parable this morning. All I wanted to do was tell you one more time that the music of the kingdom is happiness, not duty, though that is one of the main roads to happiness, not discipline, though one can hardly live without it, but comradeship, good times, sharing, laughter, all in all a feast so irresistible that people will want very much, as those did who came into our company today, to become a part of it. So give them a warm welcome and think about them until you will be able to call their names a month from now. I told someone a few weeks ago that there is a profound truth for churches. In that lovely little song that introduces the TV comedy called Cheers. I want you to hear it. And just for this once, I want us to be a creedal church. And I want this to become your creed. I want you to practice it when you say hello to Steve and Jackie Van Buskirk, who are wearing the red carnations, and when you welcome this group this morning. You want to go where everybody knows your name. There is no one here who cannot bring that gift of recognition and greeting to others in this church every Sunday morning. And I beg you, with the deepest sincerity, to do it.